Welcome, everyone, to another deep dive. Hi, I'm Pat, and I'm really glad you're here with us today for what I think will be a truly profound conversation.
And I'm Jesse. It's always a pleasure to unpack these complex topics with you. And this one, well, perhaps more than any other, it really touches us all.
Today, we're embarking on a journey into a topic that is deeply human, universally felt, and yet often kind of remarkably misunderstood. Grief. We've meticulously pulled together quite a stack of insightful sources for this deep dive, everything from clinical definitions and, you know, neuroscientific theories to really personal stories that just illuminate the raw experience of loss.
Yeah, those personal stories are powerful.
They really are. Our mission today is to move beyond the common assumptions, really, and truly understand what grief means, why our brains seem to be wired for it, and maybe how we can approach it not just with resilience, but with a deeper sense of reflection and self-compassion.
That's right. We want to try and peel back the intricate layers of this emotion, sort of unearth its surprising purpose, maybe, and explore how it manifests in such vastly diverse ways. We'll be looking at perspectives that range from, you know, the biological underpinnings, our primal brain's reaction to loss, all the way to its profound impact across different ages, relationships, even across species, actually.
Wow, okay.
That's a vast landscape, but one that I think offers incredible insight into the human condition.
Okay, so let's unpack this. When we hear the word grief, our minds almost instinctively jump straight to, well, the sadness we feel after a death.
Right. That's the default.
But what our sources reveal is that grief is far, far more expansive and complex than just that one reaction. It's not really a singular emotion, is it?
Absolutely not. Yeah. Grief is described as abstract, highly complex, and intensely subjective. It really encompasses a vast, often quite chaotic range of emotions.
Chaotic is a good word for it.
It is. And it's crucial to understand the distinction our sources make here. Bereavement is the state of having experienced a loss, sort of the objective fact of it.
Okay.
But grief, that's our dynamic, multifaceted, and deeply personal reaction to that loss. It's the entire internal and external process we go through.
And crucially, as you just touched on, it's not solely about death, right? We can grieve for so many different kinds of losses throughout our lives. What are some of the other significant forms of loss our sources highlight?
Yeah, that's such an important point. Our sources beautifully illustrate that people grieve for a whole array of life. Changes things like unemployment, the sudden onset of ill health, the painful dissolution of a long-term relationship, or even a profound loss of self that can come with major life transitions. This broad category where the loss isn't tangible or, you know, clearly defined is often termed ambiguous loss. It's a concept meticulously researched and coined by Dr. Pauline Boss way back in the 1970s. It's basically a loss that lacks clear closure or definition.
Ambiguous loss.
Yeah, this concept really opened up a new dimension for me, especially when one of our sources shared this really personal story about grieving someone who wasn't dead.
Oh, right. I remember that one.
This person, Sarah, recounted losing a close friend who just walked out of her life, described it as a short, sharp sting, blocked her from all contact, offered no explanation whatsoever, just gone.
Wow. Her experience is such a powerful illustration of the psychological dimension of ambiguous loss. You can see how Sarah felt not only the sudden, unexplained absence of a close friend, but also this unsettling loss of a part of her own identity that had been shaped by that friendship.
Yeah, makes sense.
And that was coupled with a deep sense of betrayal and confusion. She vividly describes weeks of intense, raw emotions, you know, desperately wanting answers that never came, followed by months consumed by anger. She even admitted harboring this fierce wish that the other person could feel just a fraction of her pain.
Oof. It's a potent reminder that the grief we experience can often be tangled up with other powerful emotions like anger, confusion, maybe a longing for justice or closure that isn't coming.
But how did that journey evolve for her over time? Did she, you know, ever find a sense of peace or resolution?
Well, over the years, she found herself moving between these intense periods of anger and then just a quiet, profound missing of the person. She discovered that the hole, as she put it, that had been left in her life slowly, organically began to fill with new and rekindled connections, deepening bonds with family, the warmth of existing friends, the richness of new experiences.
She took fear.
Yeah. And she noted that the earliest, almost imperceptible sign of genuine healing was feeling a kind of neutral rather than painful reaction at the mere mention of their name. This deeply personal journey taught her a powerful lesson. That grief never truly ends in a definitive, finite way. but rather you gradually build resilience around it. The heavy weight of the past no longer defines or diminishes your present. It transforms.
So grief isn't just one emotion. It's this complex, kind of shapeless thing. But what does it actually feel like? On a personal level, I know it can be incredibly overwhelming, almost physically debilitating sometimes.
You're absolutely right. It's frequently described as a chaotic emotional storm.
Yeah.
And from a clinical perspective, the early stages of bereavement often trigger this intense release of stress hormones,
right,
which can deeply affect both our physical and mental health. People commonly report a racing heart, symptoms that closely resemble clinical depression, severely disrupted sleep patterns.
I was asleep, yes.
And powerful, almost paralyzing feelings of despair, anxiety, and an often unacknowledged anger.
Yeah.
It's a systemic response, you know,
yeah,
not just emotional.
And the personal accounts in our sources are just incredibly vivid here. I read one person describe it as a heavy burning sensation on my chest that doesn't go away, and it takes every thought with it. Others recounted experiencing intense brain fog, getting lost mid-sentence in conversations, or feeling this overwhelming urge to constantly replay the last moments they had with the person they lost, or simply being utterly drained from crying.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Some descriptions plumb even deeper, speaking of an unbearable pain that hurts beyond death, or a profound, almost literal burning hollowness in the chest.
That's intense.
It really is. And the metaphor of grief as a stairmaster, that really resonated with me.
How so?
Well, it's tough at first. You find a rhythm, maybe, but then the speed unpredictably increases and you have to readjust all over again.
Yeah.
That captures its persistent, evolving, and often unpredictable nature so well. And then there's this idea mentioned in our sources of a lost loved one being trapped in your mind. That phrase alone carries so much weight.
It does. It feels like a very real experience for many. How does that concept kind of tie into this emotional and physical landscape we're talking about?
Well, this poignant thought comes from the idea that there are, in a sense, three deaths. The first is when the body ceases to function. The second is when the body is consigned to the grave or, you know, ashes scattered. But the third death, the one we truly have agency over, is the moment when the person's name is spoken for the very last time.
I've heard that before.
It suggests that grief isn't just about what's lost, but about how we actively engage with memory. Carrying those memories forward, continuing to tell their stories, and allowing their spirit and influence to, quote, experience things through your actions.
Right.
Through the choices you make, the love you give, it's a powerful way to ensure they live on long past that third death.
Yeah.
It transforms their presence from just a static memory into an active part of your continued life.
This raises such an important, almost counterintuitive question, though. From an evolutionary perspective, grief seems incredibly costly. It's painful, even debilitating. Why would our brains develop such a process? It almost feels like a fundamental flaw sometimes.
That's a truly fascinating puzzle, isn't it? And one that neuroscience has been grappling with. One compelling theory, highlighted in our sources by neuroscientist Mary Frances O'Connor, points to our ancient brains in a modern world.
Okay, ancient brains.
Yeah. Our mammalian and early human ancestors developed this intense fundamental need for closeness and connection, for survival, you know, for protection, for finding food, for raising offspring.
Makes sense. Safety in numbers.
Exactly. So when an important person in that social unit died, our limbic system, often called our primal or emotional brain, still sounded the alarm. It struggled to process the permanence of the loss, almost expecting them to return, as if they'd just gone out to pick berries and would be back any minute.
Okay.
This hardwiring for connection, designed for a world where separation was often temporary, now has to contend with the absolute finality of death in our modern lives.
So our deep, hardwired need for connection means our brains really struggle to accept permanent separation, and that struggle basically manifests as grief. That makes so much sense when you frame it in our evolutionary past.
It really does. But, you know, other hypotheses offer different, equally insightful perspectives. Freud, for example, suggested grief is a process he called libidinal reinvestment.
Okay, that sounds technical.
It does. But essentially, it means it's a painful but necessary disengagement from the deceased. This intense emotional work of grieving frees up emotional energy, or libido, as he called it, allowing it to be reinvested into new attachments and new life experiences.
So untangling those bonds.
Basically, yes.
Yeah.
Slowly untangling of those emotional bonds to allow for future connections. Then you have John Archer from an attachment theory perspective, who viewed grief more as a natural byproduct of our human capacity to form deep, meaningful commitments.
Right.
While this capacity for strong social bonds is generally adaptive, great for social cohesion, species survival, it becomes profoundly painful when death makes reunion utterly impossible.
And wasn't there also an idea that grief serves as a painful but maybe instructive memory, almost like a warning?
Yes, exactly. Randolph Nesse proposed that grief helps orient the sufferer to a new existence without the deceased, essentially creating an intensively painful memory that discourages repeating behaviors that might have led to such a profound loss.
Like a biological lesson.
Kind of, yeah. An agonizing one, but maybe a lesson in avoidance. And more recently, some researchers have even suggested that grief acts as a socially selected signal.
A signal? How so?
A signal of one's commitment and capacity for strong, faithful bonds. So from this viewpoint, openly grieving could actually make individuals seem like more desirable alliance partners within a group, demonstrating their loyalty and capacity for deep connection.
Huh. Never thought of it that way. So what does this all mean when we put it together? Is grief an evolutionary maladaptation? As some might wonder, something that's actually bad for our survival in the long run.
Not at all, actually. And this is a key takeaway from our sources. Despite its undeniable pain, many experts argue it is not a maladaptation. It's not some harmful trait that evolution should have weeded out.
Okay.
Instead, grief is seen as a necessary adaptive process for the brain to reorganize itself when fundamental certainty is just destroyed. It's about accepting the reality and the value of the loss, and then literally rewiring neural circuits to adapt to a new reality.
So it helps us adapt.
In essence, yes. Grieving helps humans adapt to change and loss, preventing them from getting stuck in an old reality that no longer exists. It's a painful but vital preparation for future losses and eventually for our own mortality. It's really a testament to our profound capacity to love and to adapt.
Since grief is such a profoundly individual and often, let's face it, tumultuous journey, are there common paths or maybe stages people typically go through? Or is it truly just a chaotic experience for everyone?
That's a great question, and one that often leads to misunderstanding, I think. While the stages of grief are frequently talked about, thanks largely to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's groundbreaking work.
Right, denial, anger.
Exactly. It's absolutely crucial to remember that these stages are not linear. You don't just complete one and neatly move to the next, like climbing stairs. Our sources emphasize that people often flip in and out of them, revisit stages, sometimes rapidly. These stages typically include denial, which sort of serves to stagger our exposure to the pain, anger, which is a vital and healthy emotion that needs to be felt fully, bargaining, where we ask those endless what if or if only questions, desperately trying to make sense of the past, depression, which is a very normal, understandable response to profound loss. And finally, acceptance.
And acceptance doesn't mean being okay with it, right?
Exactly. It isn't about feeling good about the loss necessarily, but about recognizing and adapting to the new circumstances. It's about making peace with what is.
So it sounds like trying to bypass or, you know, just ignore grief altogether would be a significant mistake then, wouldn't it?
Oh, it would be, without a doubt.
Yeah.
One of the most pervasive myths about grief is that the pain will simply vanish if you ignore it, if you just stay strong or keep busy.
Yeah, you hear that a lot.
You do. But our sources emphatically emphasize the opposite. Hiding, suppressing, or trying to intellectualize away difficult feelings only prolongs and complicates the process. To truly move through grief, you need to experience the full messy spectrum of emotions it brings.
Right.
And another harmful myth is that grief is this deeply personal thing you must work through alone, maybe out of a desire not to burden others.
If ignoring it doesn't work and trying to handle it alone isn't ideal, what does work, according to the research? What helps?
Well, managing grief, the sources suggest, is fundamentally about accepting and actively working with it, rather than trying to overcome it or solve it or defeat it like an opponent.
Working with it. I like that.
Yeah. Turning to trusted loved ones for ample ongoing support is absolutely key. Sharing your feelings, your pain, your challenges, even the mundane daily struggles helps immensely. Joining support groups can also be hugely beneficial, especially for combating those profound feelings of loneliness and isolation that often accompany grief. It helps you realize you are far from alone in your experience.
That validation must be powerful.
Incredibly. And the Mayo Clinic also specifically suggests that early counseling can be really valuable for those identified at high risk of complicated grief, acting almost as a preventative measure.
I recall a truly powerful quote in our sources that seems to tie all of this together, this idea of accepting and working with grief and the role of love in it all.
Yes, I think I know the one you mean. It's a beautiful insight from one of the pet bereavement stories, but its wisdom applies universally. Grief is just love with no place to go.
That hits hard.
It does. The author of Tika's story found profound healing in welcoming grief like an old friend, consciously refraining from numbing her emotions. She realized that grief is love. They are dual protagonists, like two sides of the same coin.
Wow.
She found that honoring her grief was, in fact, honoring her beloved pet. And what's truly insightful is how she channeled that grief into positive, life-affirming actions, like helping others who were grieving, dedicating herself to self-care, which she described as feeding her grief with joy.
Feeding grief with joy. That's a profound reframing.
Isn't it? It's about transformation, not eradication.
Shifting gears slightly, you mentioned earlier that grief manifests differently depending on age and relationship. How does it affect children and adolescents, for example, given their developing understanding of the world?
Yeah, that's a critical area, because grief reactions in youth are so deeply influenced by their ongoing developmental processes. Unaddressed or maladaptive grief in young people can sadly lead to significant mental and behavioral problems later on.
Okay.
For younger children, difficulty engaging in typical activities might manifest as failing to achieve developmental milestones, almost like a regression. Intense emotional pain can be expressed as heightened irritability, frequent tantrums, or even oppositional behavior, which can often be mistaken for other issues.
Right.
And a child under 5, lacking that cognitive understanding of permanence, might express disbelief about a death, unlike older children who grasp its finality more clearly.
And I'm curious, what does separation distress or existential distress look like in young people? How do those present themselves at different ages?
Good question. Separation distress is a powerful component. Younger children might experience behavioral regressions, like bedwetting or clinginess, or they might persistently expect the deceased to return, maybe waiting by the door or setting a place at the table.
Oh, heartbreaking.
It is. Older children might express a literal wish to physically reunite, like talking about climbing a ladder to heaven. And tragically, in adolescence, this can sometimes manifest as a wish to die or fantasies of dying themselves to be a lost loved one.
Oh, my goodness.
Then there's existential distress, dealing with the meaning of life and death. In younger children, this can appear as profound lethargy, social withdrawal, or a loss of interest in play. Adolescents, grappling with identity and purpose, might exhibit extreme risk-taking behaviors, an unsettling indifference to safety, or express a feeling that life itself holds no meaning whatsoever.
It sounds like caregivers play an absolutely vital role here, perhaps even more so than with adults navigating grief.
They do. Their role is absolutely critical. A supportive caregiving environment where adults are sensitive to a child's distress, provide consistent reassurance, and instill a strong sense of security that significantly impacts a child's ability to cope and heal.
Mm-hmm.
Open, honest discussions about grief and loss also help children form more positive continuing bonds with the deceased, allowing them to integrate the loss into their lives in a healthy way rather than severing the connection entirely.
And what about the other side of that coin? The loss of a child for parents? Our sources include some truly heartbreaking stories about that unique form of grief.
Yes, the death of a child is universally described in our sources as almost unbearably devastating for parents. It consistently carries higher risk factors for complicated grief and long-term distress than virtually any other loss, including spousal loss or even suicide.
Wow. Higher than anything else.
Yeah. It's described not as something one gets over, but as a lifelong process of assimilation, of learning to live with an unimaginable void. Parents often experience pervasive guilt, that torturous questioning of what if or what could I have done differently. But stories like Monica's, Mark's, and Deanna's included in our research beautifully illustrate how parents, despite the profound pain, find unique ways to cope. This often includes intensive self-care, focusing on surviving children, finding solace and understanding in support groups, and most importantly, consistently talking about and honoring their loved ones.
And what about our furry family members? Do animals grieve too? This always seems to spark curiosity.
It's a fascinating area where our understanding has truly evolved.
Mm-hmm.
Previously, grief was largely thought to be a human-only emotion, you know, a product of our complex cognition.
Right.
However, contemporary studies now show clear, observable grief-like states in a wide array of animals, particularly between bonded individuals or within social groups.
Like what kind of animals?
Well, we see profound changes in routine and behavior in species like elephants, wolves, apes, even some birds like mute swans. They might stop eating, isolate themselves, or become visibly depressed.
Really?
Yeah, there's fascinating, heart-wrenching evidence of chimpanzees carrying their dead infants for days or weeks, and elephants gathering around, touching, and even covering the remains of their dead. Mm. It powerfully highlights that deep bonds and the subsequent experience of loss are not exclusively human.
That's incredible. We've discussed what we might consider typical grief in all its messy forms, but our sources also delve into something called complicated grief. What specifically distinguishes it from the normal, albeit painful, process we've been describing?
That's a crucial distinction, and one that often leads people to wonder if their own grief is somehow abnormal. Complicated grief, or what clinicians now often refer to as persistent complex bereavement disorder, is indeed distinct from typical grief. While the symptoms of normal grief, as painful as they are, gradually lessen in intensity over time and allow for a return to daily functioning, those of complicated grief stubbornly linger or even worsen.
They don't fade.
Right. They become debilitating, preventing recovery, and significantly impairing one's ability to engage with life. It's like being trapped in an ongoing heightened state of mourning, unable to integrate the loss into one's life and move forward.
What are some of the key signs that someone might be experiencing complicated grief? When should we start thinking about maybe seeking professional help?
Well, the symptoms are often severe and persistent. They include an extreme, almost obsessive focus on the loss, intense longing for the deceased that just dominates every thought, pervasive problems accepting the death as real, feelings of numbness, bitterness, or an inability to experience any joy or pleasure in life. There's often profound sadness, significant trouble with daily routines, persistent social withdrawal, and a deep-seated feeling that life holds absolutely no meaning without the deceased. It's frequently described as a combination of intense separation distress and traumatic distress symptoms.
And what puts someone at a higher risk for developing this more severe, debilitating form of grief? Are there certain factors?
Yes, several factors can increase the risk. These include experiencing an unexpected or violent death, like a car accident, murder, or suicide, the particularly devastating loss of a child, as we mentioned,
right,
having a very close or highly dependent relationship with the deceased, significant social isolation, or a pre-existing history of mental health conditions like depression, separation anxiety, or PTSD. Traumatic childhood experiences or major financial hardships also seem to elevate the risk. These factors can just make the grieving process much harder to navigate naturally.
So what are the implications if complicated grief isn't addressed? If someone just tries to push through it on their own, what can happen?
Without appropriate professional treatment, the complications can be quite severe and long-lasting. These can include chronic depression, an increased risk of suicidal thoughts or behaviors, severe anxiety disorders, significant and persistent sleep disturbances.
Wow.
And even an increased risk of physical illnesses like heart disease. There's also long-term difficulty with daily living, maintaining relationships, or performing at work. And sadly, substance misuse is also a significant risk, as individuals may try to self-medicate their intense pain. It truly often requires intervention.
Given all of that, when should someone genuinely consider seeking professional help for their grief? What are the sort of red flags to look out for?
The general guidance is quite clear. If you find yourself unable to cope with daily life, if you're using excessive amounts of drugs or alcohol to numb the pain, if you become severely or persistently depressed, or critically, if you have thoughts of guilt, self-blame, or most concerningly, wish you had died along with your loved one, it is absolutely crucial to reach out for professional help and counseling soon after a loss, especially for those with identified risk factors, can also be a powerful preventive measure, helping individuals explore their emotions in a safe space and learn healthy coping skills before grief potentially becomes complicated.
Wow, Jesse, this deep dive really, it just illustrates how truly universal and profoundly impactful grief is in all its myriad forms, from its ancient evolutionary purpose to its unique manifestations across different ages and relationships, it's abundantly clear that grief is a fundamental, albeit incredibly painful, part of the human experience. It really is a testament to our capacity for deep connection.
And that understanding, I think, reminds us that rather than something to overcome or get over, grief is something to accept, to actively work with, and ultimately to integrate into the fabric of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
By acknowledging it fully, by allowing ourselves to feel the entire spectrum of emotions, and by courageously seeking support, we can navigate this challenging path. And in doing so, we might even find a deeper connection to love itself, realizing that grief is not the opposite of love, but maybe its profound echo.
So as you reflect on grief in your own life or the lives of those around you, perhaps consider this. If grief truly is love with nowhere to go, what new places can you consciously create for that love to flow? Not just in memory, but in building a more resilient, compassionate future.
Mm.
We truly hope this deep dive into grief has offered you some valuable insights and perhaps maybe even a measure of comfort.
Thank you for joining us on this deeply reflective journey. We really encourage you to continue exploring these topics, to seek understanding, and maybe most importantly, to extend kindness and empathy, knowing that everyone, in their own way, is navigating their own difficult path.
We hope you'll come back for our next deep dive. If you enjoy this conversation, please like, share, and maybe leave a comment to let us know your thoughts. Until next time.
Goodbye for now.